KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Pacific Heights.
I live in Fremont.
I live in Russian Valley in the Richmond District.
I live in the Inner Sunset.
I live in the Outer Sunset.
Coming up, we'll hear how Berkeley protesters helped bring about the Americans with Disabilities Act 40 years ago today.
So essentially, at the bottom of it all was that any organization had to be made accessible to people with disabilities. And this was the first time that that was said.
Then we'll hear from a theater artist who transformed her experience during the AIDS epidemic into a surprisingly funny play.
I think it's also true that when people laugh, there's something that opens up and you're more willing to listen.
Fighting to be heard. That's coming up on Cross Currents. 40 years ago today, more than 100 people with disabilities took over a San Francisco federal building. They vowed to stay until the government agreed to sign a long-awaited piece of civil rights legislation, Section 504, the precursor of the Americans with Disabilities Act.
For the disabled, the signing of Regulation 504 is the difference between living and existing.
We're more than handicapped without these laws. We're crippled.
Taking cues from the civil rights movement of the 60s, the disability community rose to fight segregation and discrimination throughout the 1970s. KALW's True Quinn brings us this often untold story of a movement catalyzed right here in the Bay Area.
Ever wonder what that building is connected to the Ashby BART station in South Berkeley?
Concord.
Go up the ramp and you'll be entering the Ed Roberts campus. There are extra wide elevators and big buttons at the base of the elevator to select your floor. The campus is spacious with lots of natural light. Every bit was designed carefully for people with disabilities.
Really, what is disability?
That's Dimitri Belser. He's the executive director of the Center for Accessible Technology. He's also president of the Ed Roberts campus.
Disability is a disconnect between people's abilities and the built environment. I think a lot of disability is actually affected by architecture.
The campus was constructed using universal design, making it one of the easiest spaces to get around in. Built to memorialize Ed Roberts, the center continues his work for people with disabilities.
He had had polio as a teenager, and he used an iron lung for part of his life. So he was quadriplegic. He had very, very little mobility. So a pretty significant disability. And this is in the 1950s and the early 1960s. And this is the time when most people with disabilities with his kind of a disability ended up institutionalized.
Roberts was the first person with severe disabilities to attend UC Berkeley. At the time, the dorms weren't accessible, so Roberts lived in Cowell Hall, the school's hospital. Other students with disabilities eventually began living there too.
This is also during the time of the free speech movement, which is when students were starting to talk about their rights to protest and their rights to speak on whatever topic they wanted, and that students had rights.
A group of students living in Cowell Hall, all quadriplegic, dubbed themselves the Rolling Quads, and they had something to say. They realized they were not patients, but an oppressed minority. From lowering countertops and telephones to widening bathroom doors, the Rolling Quads opened up the campus to people in wheelchairs, making UC Berkeley one of the most accessible in the country. Beyond structural changes, Ed Roberts and the Rolling Quads started the independent living movement.
It was a very radical concept that people with disabilities, how can someone who can't dress themselves or bathe themselves or feed themselves, how can that person live independently?
The Center for Independent Living was the first of its kind back in 1972. It was a place where people could go to find housing, jobs, and get advice from one another. There are now 403 of these centers across the country. Belster lost his vision in his 20s and says the work done by people like Ed Roberts allows him to live independently and freely.
I can tell you, as a blind person, if I had been born in the 1920s, my life would have been very different because I probably would have been in some sort of sheltered workshop, or I would have been on relief, you know, on disability, on Social Security my entire life and not been able to work. And I've had a whole career because of the work that people like Ed Roberts did.
Catherine Kudlick, historian and director of the Paul K. Longmore Institute on Disability, says Berkeley's push for independence in the 60s led to a national battle for civil rights in the 70s. In 1974, the Rehabilitation Act was passed by Congress to benefit veterans returning home from Vietnam with a disability. But one section, Section 504, affected the larger community.
It was the first time civil rights language had been applied to disability, and that's where it's significant. So essentially, at the bottom of it all was that any organization, that could be a hospital, a school, a university, the post office, federal buildings, anything, had to be made accessible to people with disabilities. And this was the first time that that was said.
But both the Nixon and Ford administrations refused to sign Section 504. When President Carter took office in January of 1977, people were hopeful. Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare Joseph Califano said he would sign it, but...
I will sign a set of 504 regulations by early May.
Now
I will do it
now! Not May, now!
By April of 1977, people refused to wait any longer.
It all started this morning here at the old federal building on 50 Fulton when an incident took place outside. Immediately after that demonstration this morning, the handicapped started invading the building.
It's the first really militant thing that disabled people have ever done. And we feel like we're building a real social movement. And we want people to listen to us. We have tried negotiations. They do not work. And at this point, we are non-negotiable. We want those regulations signed.
News outlets call them an army of cripples. This army, the deaf, blind, people in wheelchairs, with canes, gathered and occupied 10 federal offices across the U.S. The nation shouted. After just a few days, the occupations in D.C. and the rest of the nation fizzled, but not in San Francisco, where over 150 people gathered, including Ed Roberts.
We're down to the bottom line, down to the basic issue here. Are we going to perpetuate segregation in our society?
The sit-in at the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare offices continued and was able to go on for nearly a month.
The Bay Area had this culture of collaboration in place already, and people, there was a real sense of common understanding and common purpose, and people had met each other and cared about each other. And even if they didn't know, the sort of mood of the time was to advocate for rights and to think about groups that weren't getting their rights.
Dennis Billups thinks back to 40 years ago and remembers the Black Panthers bringing him and other demonstrators supplies during the building takeover.
They bought bandages, soap, all kinds of food. We're talking about beans and rice, chicken, turkey, ham.
24 at the time, Billups had a specific job during the occupation, chief morale officer. He says there was one reason for this.
Nobody had a bigger mouth than I did.
Billups made his rounds each day to keep the vibration up, he says. It was the first time he got to know people with varying disabilities.
504 is victory here. We ain't leaving nowhere. Rolling in my wheelchair now. Feeling victory in my bones right now. I'm empowered by the sounds of faith. Calling 504 is here to stay.
Billups says protesters used their different abilities to help one another.
You know, we were their ears and they were our eyes, our hands and feet to do stuff. And it was a cooperation of empowerment that was so strong and so powerful and fearless. To me, that was important because society could actually learn from this and do the same thing and become empowered to do greater things than they're doing now.
There was a moment during the occupation when the hot water was shut off, along with the phone lines. Anyone who left the building was not allowed back in. The occupiers had no way to send messages, so deaf people stood at the windows and used sign language to communicate to people below in the street.
They signed everything from grocery lists or medical requests to, you know, this is what's going on inside. And so interpreters outside then would read the signs and then write down the press releases, and they got the word out to the media. So it's this amazing moment of cooperation.
After the nearly month-long occupation, Secretary Califano signed Section 504. Under law, people with disabilities now had a right to accessible public buildings and education, the right to federal employment, housing, and health care. Outside of the building, at San Francisco Civic Center, activist and organizer Kitty Cohn spoke to a jubilant crowd.
We showed strength and courage and power and commitment. Solidarity. That we the shut-ins or the shut-outs, we the hidden, supposedly the frail and the weak, that we could wage a struggle at the highest level of government and win.
Kovic says getting Section 504 signed laid the groundwork for the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, which banned discrimination in all areas of public life. Kovic also points out, one unique thing about the disability community is that anyone can join at any time.
You know, you could have a disease, a car accident, just a random thing that happens to you, and you could need all of these accommodations and benefits. And if you get older, you know, you're going to need all of it anyway. We're making an investment in our society when we have something like the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Today, one in five Americans has a disability. Some you can see, some you can't. Kovic says that just because the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA, exists, doesn't mean discrimination and segregation, intentional or otherwise, doesn't happen.
The way a society treats its most vulnerable citizens is really an indication of the worth of that society. And if you basically toss out groups because they're not powerful or not important or not worth it, one, you know, it's just morally wrong. But two, you're missing out on some people that really have amazing insights and amazing things to contribute to society. But you're going to need to put some basic parameters in place.
There are still a lot of barriers for people with disabilities. Not all businesses comply with the ADA. If you have a disability, you're more likely to be unemployed, more likely to live in poverty. Civil rights language written into law is an important foundation, says Kudlick, but it takes more than that to wrestle with stigma and the built environment. In Berkeley, I'm True Gwynn for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Julie Kane, in for Hanat Bhabha. January 28, 1986 was a difficult day in American history. It was the day of the Challenger explosion, and was also right in the middle of the AIDS epidemic that swept the country. It's over the course of that one day that Elaine Magree unfolds her story in the one-woman show Holding the Edge. In it, she shares her own experiences of being a hospice nurse in Oakland during that era, and how she tried to balance motherhood, political activism, sobriety, and faith in the goodness of the world. Magree talked to KALW's Jen Chien about putting her own life on the stage.
In the show, you talk about the difference between Nurse Elaine and Plain Elaine. Can you explain that difference for people who haven't seen your show?
Sure. Like anyone, when you're at work, there may be a slightly different persona that you live in while at work. You probably don't say every single thing to your people you work with that you might say to a friend. So I think people in healthcare have to develop a persona that's both authentic, competent, but you can't say every single thing. Like, if you were with a friend and you encountered a bad smell, you'd probably say, oh God, that smells horrible. But you don't do that professionally. There's also moderating your degree of emotional engagement. As Plain Elaine, as myself or yourself, we might engage emotionally in something wholeheartedly. A sad situation might make us weep. But
this seems especially relevant if you're a hospice nurse, which is sad. People are dying.
That's
their
right.
Family members are sad around you.
That's right. That's right. And while it's just so tricky to be open to feeling the reality of the situation, but at the same time not go into the depth of emotion that you might have, because your job is to kind of hold the container for everyone else, as well as add the spices and stir.
Crying doesn't get the job done, but not detached or disconnected either. That's so isolating for people. They're like, how can you just be talking normally when my whole world is coming to an end? So when I can, the middle way. I open up a channel between me and the other person, and everything else goes soft focus and drifts away. There's just what you need and how I can give it to you.
Your show deals with a lot of dark subjects. So there's death, as we talked about. There's the kind of large tragedy of the AIDS epidemic. There's the Challenger disaster that happens on the day that the show takes place. There's also a whole lot of humor. There's a lot of laughter. So can you talk about the balance between those two things in your experience of the events in your own past, and then how you thought about bringing that balance to the stage?
I think because in particular the show is rooted in what we called gay culture, now we would probably call queer culture. I think that camp is a survival tool of queer culture that men developed, that of taking things that were used to shame us and turning them around and making them strengths and flaunting them. And I really tried to capture that spirit throughout the piece. Some of it is a love letter to that aspect of gay male culture.
So, dying with AIDS, it'll be from an infection. And it'll be pretty quick. 2 years, 5 hospitals, that's not quick. You're right, Elsie, of course. Do you have any fears? Oh, yeah, of being left out. And that the afterlife nuns have no glitter.
Everyone I'm close to, I tend to be close to people who are irreverent and who cope by making jokes. When my father died, he was in his 90s. He'd had a long, wonderful life, and we were all gathered in his room in a nursing home, and he'd gone on longer than anyone expected. My brother, two of my brothers were there, my son was there, his wife was there, and my brother went out of the room to get a soda, and while he was out of the room, my father died. And I knew, I was watching and other people were talking, and when he came back in the room, I kind of gave him what we used to call the hairy eyeball. I stared at him, and then I looked at my dad, and I looked at him, and I looked at my dad, and he got it, and he held up his Coke and said, things go better with Coke. And that,
oh my goodness,
that's my family.
Yeah.
I grew up with humor as a coping mechanism, and it was completely appropriate for how everyone was feeling at the time. And I've just always been drawn to that. And when I first started, the second part of your question was how did I bring that in? When I first started working on the piece, I was in a little writing group, and they were fascinated by all the details of what happened at a death. And they kept saying, tell me more, tell me more. And it was getting longer and longer and longer describing all these details. And when I first brought it into our writing group, our mentor, David Ford, who's a brilliant developer of solo theater, said, you have to have some other colors in there. You just can't go on kind of like that.
Even if it's fascinating.
Yeah,
It was just bringing you down and down?
It was monotone in a certain kind of way. And then that's when I started working on several different threads that I could weave in that would make it funnier. I think it's also true that when people laugh, there's something that opens up and you're more willing to listen. And then when you go into a deep place, you're more willing or more need laugh as a release. So going back and forth between those two has been really fascinating in this piece.
You have a thing in the show about saying sorry, about how when you said I'm sorry to your patients as a hospice nurse, that it took the focus off of them and onto yourself in a way that didn't feel right to you.
People are so generous. I can tell somebody about their impending death, and if I say sorry, they take care of me. Like, oh dear, it's not your fault. So I'm trying not to say that anymore.
Can you just talk about that a little bit for folks who haven't seen the show?
I've noticed with patients and in other situations, sometimes when people say, I'm sorry, they're saying, please forgive me. Really, there's an underlying, I feel so upset, I don't know what to do, I'm going to say I'm sorry. And sometimes it does put the other person in a situation of trying to take care of them. And I wanted to be really clear as a healthcare provider that almost never did I want someone to have to take care of me. There were very, very few occasions where it became clear that a patient or family needed to give me a gift in order to keep the balance of energy and to be comfortable. And even though we weren't allowed to receive gifts, people would want to give you a bag of lemons. At that time, we agreed we would accept them because it was really for them more than for us. But mostly saying sorry to people diverts them from what they're experiencing and makes them think about, oh, do I say, you know, it's not your fault, or, oh, don't worry about it, or it requires a response. So I just started not saying that and finding other things to try and say with people. But I also acknowledge in the play, it's a totally human thing to say, and people say it for the very best reasons. And I don't want to criticize anyone. It was just something I found in my work. And I decided to leave it in the play. And it's resonated with a lot of people. But I do, you know, clearly say it's just human to say you're sorry.
That was Elaine Magree speaking about her solo theater show, Holding the Edge, with KALW's Jen Chien. You can see the play yourself in its closing performances this Friday and Saturday at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. For more details, head to KALW.org, click Cross Currents. And that's it for us today. Our team includes Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Jeremy Ju, Lisa Morehouse, James Rollins, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Carrie Spivak, and Andrew Stelzer. Today's show was engineered by Ted Muldoon. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane.
Today is Julie Kane's last day at KALW, and we are going to miss her. We'll miss you, Julie.
We love you,
Julie. Bye,
Julie.
We'll
love
miss you,
Julie.
Julie.
Bye.
We're so
proud of you.
Let's dance.
Good luck.
Julie.
Congratulations.
Good luck.
Glamorous.
Come
back and visit.
Totally.
Thank you.